Hi, this is Tim Lightfoot, the director of the Huff Heinz Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I am so excited to let you know that the Huff Heinz Institute now has apps for your smartphones and your tablets. We have apps for the Apple products and for Android products. You can go to iTunes or go to Google Play, either one. Download those Huff Heinz apps, and you can pull in our content every week. Now, on to the podcast.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huff Heinz Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huff Heinz Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huff Heinz Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huff Heinz Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Lightfoot, and I'm so glad that you took the time to download us and you're listening. We bring you every week interesting people from the world of sports medicine and human performance, and this week is no exception. We have Dr. David Thompson with us. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell the audience a little bit about you, and then we will just jump on into the conversation, okay?
That sounds great.
Super. And Dr. Thompson is currently a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He has a Ph.D. in Educational Administration from Texas A&M. As a matter of fact, all of his degrees are from Texas A&M, including a bachelor's degree right here in our home Department of Health and Kinesiology. And so this is one of our local guys that has gone off and done really well in his career. He has a wide variety of experience over the years, including time in the public school systems, where he was, one example, he was assistant principal at Westville High School in Spring, Texas. He's been the department chair there in the department that he's at University of Texas, San Antonio. And so David brings a wealth of information and experience with us. And one of Dr. Thompson's experience, or his expertise, is in the area of educational law and ethics, and in particular, he does quite a bit of consulting on this. And so we're going to talk about that today, especially in context of coaching and working with sports teams. So again, thanks for being with us today on the podcast, David. So let's just jump into this conversation here. So what led you to this area of interest of ethics and law in education?
Okay, so I got interested in this through my work as a high school assistant principal at Westfield, and it wasn't educator sexual misconduct. It was actually student-to-student sexual harassment at a time when that construct was in its infancy, mm-hmm. if you will, and when we really didn't know what the standards of liability would be for a school or an individual who didn't do the right things from a leadership perspective when there was a complaint of student-to-student sexual harassment. So we worked through the issue, and we worked through this issue for several months. And these were ninth grade students, and so we had to work through it with the students, their parents, the disciplinary system at the school. And after we got through this, we kind of stepped back, if you will, and just kind of said, you know, what was our exposure to liability? As it turned out, we did a very good job by the students and through the investigative process and giving students due process. We were able to determine what happened, and obviously we tried to make sure that the interest of all students, both the victims as well as the students who engaged in the misconduct, were served. But after that, when I became a faculty member at Texas A&M University Commerce, I ended up being the last person hired, so when you're the last hired, you get to teach whatever is left over.
Right.
And so they said, can you teach a class in education law? And I said, sure I can. I got threatening letters from three attorneys during my first semester as a high school assistant principal. I guess that qualifies me. And so...
That's a good qualification.
Yeah, and so I started teaching it. And so I started writing in that area, and that was back in 1994 and 95. And I was just interested in thinking back on that experience to see, you know, what should I have done differently? What was our exposure to liability? And that has kind of taken off as one of my my research and teaching interest, if you will. And so I got interested in the Educator's Code of Ethics, probably close, you know, more interested in the Code of Ethics closer to about 10 years ago. And that interest led to being offered the opportunity to co-author what is still the only book dedicated or that addresses, if you will, the Educator's Code of Ethics in Texas. Mm. And so that book is titled Professional Responsibility for Educators and the Texas Code of Ethics. And, you know, the Code of Ethics is something that a lot of people don't think enough about, and I think there's a good reason for that. Most people don't really see themselves or have a sufficient moral compass that they know what not to do and right. and what to do. And of course it has to do with the very few that gets all the attention in the media and gets the attention of the Texas Education Agency and all those kinds of things. So that's briefly how my interest has evolved. And I do want to mention that I was a coach as well as a public school educator. I was a high school golf coach, and I helped out with the football team and things like that as well. But I do have a coaching background, and that has always been of interest to me as well.
So let's. You mentioned the Educator's Code of Ethics. I'm not sure how many of our audience actually will even know that exists. Yeah, give us a little brief background on that. Has that been around a while? Kind of what areas does it cover? And we'll come back to the coaching thing here in a few minutes.
Sure. So the Educator's Code of Ethics was the original one was passed in 1971, I believe. Although back in the early 1900s, the state superintendent of public instruction had the authority to cancel a certificate of an educator who was found unworthy to instruct or supervise the youth of this state. And it's interesting that phrase still exists today.
That sounds like a pretty generic phrase.
Yeah, it is. And it's open to some interpretation, although it is defined in the Code of Ethics. So we've had several iterations of the Code of Ethics, and of course that Code of Ethics has been enforced nearly throughout the last 45 or 46 years. There was a time when the legislature forgot to, or didn't forget to, but you know, didn't think to address how the Code of Ethics was enforced. But today, the Code of Ethics is enforced by the State Board for Educator Certification and the Texas Education Agency staff, and it's enforced against educator certificates. Mm. So the state of Texas deals with the certification process, and local school districts deal with the employment process. Okay. It's important to understand that the same behavior can result in a contract termination as well as a certificate sanction. And so there's three categories of standards in the Educator's Code of Ethics. One is ethical conduct in and toward the profession, and the second is ethical conduct toward colleagues, and the third is ethical conduct towards students.
Well, it's interesting they split out the colleagues and the students.
They did, and it's been that way for some time. What is interesting is that there were two standards with regard to ethical conduct towards students added in the most recent rewrite of the code in 2010. And the first one has to do with maintaining appropriate boundaries between educators and students, mm-hmm. based on what is known as the reasonable person standard. And then the second one was what has come to be known as the social media standard, was added because there has been a very strong association between educator sexual misconduct and the use of social media to gain access to students in the cases that we have seen go to the Texas Education Agency.
Hmm. So they're using the social media to get to the students for inappropriate purposes.
Well, yes, and so one of the things that makes intuitive sense is that, well, in fact, there was a study 3 or 4 years ago, and I don't have the citation, but it was done by CNN, or it was reported in CNN, rather, that said that 75% of adolescents hide their online behavior from their parents. Mm-hmm. I've actually talked to high school students in districts, and I ask them, you know, I give them this question, my parents checked my online activity, A, never, B, occasionally, see frequently and D pretty much all the time. And, you know, 90% of the students will report in, you know, where I've talked to them. I can't say it's scientific, but where I've talked to them, 90% of the students will say that their parents either never or occasionally check their online activity. Mm. And so what that does is that for a person who wants to gain access to an adolescent or to a kid, whether it's an educator or not, the best way to do that is through electronic communication.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This opens up so many cans of worms, especially now in nowadays society, doesn't it, where everybody uses social media of some kind or the other to communicate.
Right. And then, you know, kids nowadays are getting, they're getting their cell phones at 10, 11, 12, and, you know, if it's true that parents and guardians are not paying as close of attention to their online activity of their children as they should be, it really does open up some problems.
Yeah. Now teachers in particular, but also specifically coaches, are probably in a situation where they have more direct contact with students.
Right.
Then most other teachers actually are adults, and so there certainly is difficult gray areas there. And again, I know you do a lot of work with student teachers and potential coaches on how to keep from getting fired and how not to, you know, and how to set up those boundaries and so forth. What are some of those guidelines that you give people?
You know, it's interesting that over the last several years, the employee handbooks have been written in such a way to do some of the same things. But if you're going to communicate electronically with a student, follow your district policies. Mm. Use district-owned platforms.
So don't use your own personal
phone. Don't use your own personal electronic telecommunication device. The policies are evolving to the point where many school districts now have put the restrictions on text messaging only to educators that have an extracurricular duty relationship with a student. Mm-hmm. But and so the first question is, am I permitted to use electronic communication? And then the second question is, the communication with students within the scope of your responsibilities? And the question that you ask yourself is, has the school district hired me to do this? And so the definition of, if you're working within the scope of your duties, it really is, am I conducting the business of the district on this electronic telecommunication device? And so if you can answer yes, you know, can I, the first question is, can I? The second is, should I? And then are my electronic communications in line with the educator's code of ethics? And so it is, you know, some people say there's a gray area. Mm-hmm. I tend to believe that if you wouldn't say it to a parent's face about their child,
right,
and if you wouldn't be happy seeing it on the front page of the newspaper or on the internet, which is the world's front page,
that's right,
there's really no reason to say it.
Right.
And so it is a matter of, you hate to say it's a matter of common sense, but if you phrase this in a way, has the district hired me to do this,
right,
I think it makes it very clear,
right,
as to what the boundaries are with regard to social media.
So there we see cases, many cases, of especially young educators, teachers who, you know, have graduated from college in the last few years. So they're 21 to 24, 25 years old, and they still have that very large social media presence, maybe on Facebook and a variety of others. What do you say to those newly hired teachers about their social media presence, even though they may not be initiating the conversation with the student? Certainly students can go and look up those people online.
That's exactly right. And I hear stories, anecdotally, educators, you know, new teachers saying, I'm getting Googled by my students.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what I tell educators, and I have, my daughter is a first year teacher. Mm. And, of course, she has heard this for a long enough time. Reduce your social media presence. Mm. Don't friend students.
Right.
You may want to be careful about friending students' parents. You don't want to friend people who are friending your students.
Right.
And so, or follow people who follow your students. And so it really is putting up a boundary around your social media presence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, go in and clean up your social media presence.
Right.
If there's stuff on there that you wouldn't want your mom to see, or that you wouldn't feel comfortable with your pastor putting up on an overhead in your church, you know, it probably doesn't belong on your social media site, because educators are role models. We occupy the same position as members of the police force and members of the clergy.
Right.
We really do, and even the Supreme Court has said educators are role models, and the court cases tell us that if you're away from campus activities adversely affect your ability to discharge your duties as an educator, that conduct is not beyond the reach of the school district and is not beyond the reach of the Texas Education Agency.
And that idea of cleaning up your social media and limiting your social media presence, that's difficult to some extent with today's generation, because certainly this generation has been accused oftentimes of oversharing.
Right, and so, you know, they are the digital natives, right? Mm-hmm. And so they've grown up with these social media presence. They've grown up with a social media ubiquitousness, if you will. And so that's why I think it's really important that we talk to our future educators as quickly as possible in our educator preparation programs.
Right.
And so I talk to our folks at UTSA. I'm getting increasing number of invitations to go talk to other student teachers. And I know educator prep programs are doing that.
Right.
The other thing I think it's important to see is what happens to educators who slip up. You know, in fact, if you're a fan of the Eagles, they sing a song in a New York minute, and it really can change in a New York minute.
Well, you know, and there's also this misconception in the public that once a teacher gets tenure, they can never be fired. But that's certainly not the case, neither in a public school or in a institute of higher education.
No, and, you know, in Texas, our contracts are either, once you're off that probation, it's either a continuing or a term contract. But when you're talking about this type of misconduct, first of all, the state of Texas doesn't care if you're tenured or not. If you're reported to TEA for this type of misconduct, they're going to engage in a disciplinary process. And again, so that's one of the other things that I'm attempting to educate educators on, is how the disciplinary process works in Texas. Because there are certain things that if educators engage in that type of conduct, it takes the discretion away from the superintendent of the school district, and he or she has to report certain types of misconduct.
Yeah.
And then I tell educators, then your life becomes like a Zamboni going downhill on a sheet of ice with no brakes.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I think also many people don't understand. There are things that teachers have to report. I mean, they are bound by law. If they find out about potential sexual assault, sexual harassment, they are bound to report those things
to
higher administrators.
That's exactly right. And as well, all educators have a non-discretionary duty to report child abuse, mm-hmm. suspected or real child abuse or neglect. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, we have an interesting case going on right now from somewhere in North Texas, I won't mention the district, but where a teacher was actually, if you will, repudiated by their administration for reporting child abuse, suspected child abuse, directly to a municipal police department without going through the school district first. And there's no requirement that the district has to be notified before law enforcement.
Wow.
And so it was, now they're evidently, well, I've read media reports that there's been a lawsuit by the teacher against the school district for, you know, what amounts to retaliation.
Right.
So these are really, really important issues.
Right. And they're not often cut and dried. I mean, there are certainly set standards and guidelines. But these are difficult cases and difficult situations, and the last thing someone wants to do is, you know, as they say, rat out other people. But this is their job.
That's right. And the law is on the side of the person who makes a good faith, the law is on the side of a person who makes a good faith report.
Right, right. So how does this all wrap up? Do we see a bigger incidence of this in the coaching profession because of the more intimate nature of the interaction between the coach and the athlete?
It is. One would believe that that's the case. And when we say, and again, I'm a coach at heart, and so I know what great coaches do for kids. Mm-hmm. And I want to make that very clear to the audience, because the vast majority of the coaches out there, in fact, the overwhelming majority of the coaches out there, are doing it right every day. And just like a good teacher and a good coach, they're changing the lives of kids for the better.
Right.
And so, and to put this in perspective, close to a year ago, the Texas Education Agency had 338 open investigations of inappropriate relationship and sexual misconduct, and those data will be updated in a couple months again. And so 338 open investigations out of about 350,000 educators in Texas means that it's less than 1/1,000th of 1%.
Mm-hmm. It's a small number.
So it's a small percentage.
Right.
It's a large number, but a small percentage.
Right.
That said, one is too many, because we don't send our children to school to be the object of predatory educators.
Right, right. Especially if it's your child.
Especially if it's your child. Mm-hmm. And so, but what's interesting is we don't have a lot of research in this area. So, one of my doctoral students and I at UTSA are busy combing through the last 15 years of educator discipline data. Mm. We've done public records requests from TEA, and we've got boxes and boxes and boxes and pages and pages and pages, including not just the sanctions and the names, but we also have a lot of the original source documents, which are publicly available and are being increasingly digitized by TEA to make the request process easier. But we're actually going through every single educator sanction over the past 15 years to really get a sense of how prevalent this is, you know, who's committing this type of misconduct.
Right.
Is it really increasing? Well, we know that from media accounts and from what TEA has reported, we've had a 53% investigation, 53% increase in the number of investigations opened in the last 7 reporting years.
Wow.
But we also know from the literature on sexual abuse is that for every one that gets reported, there may be anywhere from 3 to 5 that don't.
Wow.
That don't get reported. And we don't know that that's true in education. We know that's true in general society. So we're putting together this database to really see who's involved, what are the demographic characteristics. Does it tend to be younger educators? Tend to be older educators? Does it tend to be educators who are engaged in extracurricular duty supervision? Mm-hmm. You know, where the relationships are closer.
Right.
I mean, they just are. The success of an educator, I think, is based on their ability to develop good relationships with their students.
Right.
But there's that boundary there, and so when that boundary goes overboard, that's when we have this issue. So it's building good relationships, but maintaining those boundaries while building those relationships.
Wow.
So the answer to your question is we hope to have really good data on that within the next several months.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that. It's been a great conversation, but unfortunately we're running out of time. So as we do with all of our guests, I'd like to give you an opportunity to give us a take-home message. What's the one thing you want the audience to remember if they remember nothing else from this podcast?
The issue issues that we have with educator sexual misconduct around the country have less to do with social media than they do with losing respect for appropriate educator-student boundaries. And it is the responsibility of the educator to maintain those boundaries and to set those boundaries and to enforce those boundaries. And to never put yourself in a position as an educator where that boundary can be breached.
So the responsibility is on the educator.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Excellent take-home message. Thank you so much, David. We've really enjoyed having you on today.
I appreciate it.
And so for those of you that are listening and listen to us on a weekly basis, you know, also at this time is when we have our podcast question of the week. And here with our podcast question of the week is our producer, Alexis.
What are the three categories of standards in the Educator's Code of Ethics mentioned by Dr. Thompson?
Great question. Be the first one to send us the correct response to that via email. You can send that email to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. And if you're the first one, you'll get one of those nifty podcast t-shirts. Don't hesitate to send it in. Don't think you're going to be too late. Send it on in. And we've been known to give out more than just one of those t-shirts. So again, send that email to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. And again, I want to thank you all for taking the time to be with us. Dr. Thompson, thank you for taking the time out of your afternoon to be with us as well.
Thank you, Dr. Lightfoot and Alexis. Appreciate the opportunity to give back a little bit to my alma mater.
You're welcome. And for those of you listening, we hope that you take the opportunity to be with us next week when we'll have another interesting individual from the world of sports medicine and human performance. And until then, we hope you stay active and healthy.
The executive producer of the Sports Medicine Podcast is Kenneth McIntyre and co-produced by Carlos Guevara and Alexis Applequist. This podcast is licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.